I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the work to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a piece that interests us some new listeners. And I say listeners because all Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Pen Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pensound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in the Arts Cafe of the Kelly Writers House by Kenneth Goldsmith, conceptual poet whose most recent book is Traffic, 2007, creator and curator of UbuWeb and teacher of, among other seminars, a class called Uncreative Writing. And by Tracy Morris, multidisciplinary poet who has worked in theater, dance, music, and film, known as a musical poet, and who has toured and performed worldwide and is anthologized all over the place. And by Joshua Schuster, whose current book-length project is about biomodernism, and among whose works is Project Experience, a little card-sized codex that looks like an ID booklet, of which Kent Johnson wrote, "If you collect small and fleeting things whose meanings build and build, get this passport. Offer it willingly to the border guard inside you." So hello, Kenny, Tracy, and Josh, and welcome to Poem Talk. Our poem today is Jaap Blanc's What the President Will Say and Do, a minute-and-a-half-long sound piece which he calls a short meditation on the title of a book by Madeline Ginz. The recording we're going to hear was made at the Writer's House in this very room during Jaap Blanc's visit from Holland on November 11, 2004. Blanc is known for his combination of three somewhat separately tending traits, a powerful stage presence, a childlike freedom of improvisation, and a very keen grasp of structure. Before we talk, let's have a listen. So here now is Jaap Blanc performing What the President Will Say and Do.
This is at this conference seance in CalArts in Los Angeles, and I met this writer, Madeline Ginz, and I would like to present a short meditation on the title of one of her books. What the President Will Say and Do. 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 For the President will send. For the President will send. What 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 the
Thank you.
Well, Kenny and Tracy, I understand that you were both at the performance of this piece at the conference that he mentions in his prefatory statement. And Josh and I were here at the Writer's House, as were you, Kenny, to hear him do it a second time. Can any of us then remember what he looks like, what he facially looks like at the very end of the piece? Kenny, what did he look
Absolutely.
Like?
Absolutely.
He ends up sort of
holding his breath and turning purple.
Yeah.
He's about 7 feet tall and close to 250 pounds. He's got an enormous stage presence. And this, of course, like many of Jaap's pieces, is an enormously physical and bodily piece that he performs. And when a man of that stature holds his breath and gags, it's absolutely unbelievable. Mm.
Tracy, what do you remember from seeing him perform?
I just remember I'm feeling a lot more comfortable. I still am not used to being around a lot of sound-based poets and performers. I'm still getting used to that idea. So
you mean you're used to being the only one in the room?
Maybe not the only one in the room, but certainly not as many in the room. And I think it was just so exciting to be around like minds or people who had a similar, you know, viewpoint about sounds was nice. So I just remember it all as being like lovely and fabulous and fun. But he was quite dramatic, which I thought was lovely, fabulous, and fun.
He's really like quiet as a mouse, almost reserved as a person, and barely says anything if you even ask him a question. And then all of a sudden on stage, he's just this transformed.
He sweats, and he really works hard. And he, at the end of the performance, he's absolutely soaked.
So what do you all think is the deficiency of having only the audio recording of this and missing the performance?
I don't think there's any deficiency because he's such a fantastic performer that the audio component of Blanc carries the day. And if you're lucky enough to see him, it's absolutely even more incredible in a different way. But I don't think anything's lost without him being there.
What the president will say and do. What the president will say and do. What the president will say and do.
Tracy, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the things about not being able to see him is that you listen. You just listen. And there are so many specific things, in my opinion, that he's doing with that piece that I think watching him do it is another phenomenon that sort of dominate our appreciation of what he's doing because he's such a striking figure.
Now, since both of you were at... Kenny and Tracy, you were at the conference. Was this an homage to Madeline Ginz? She was in the room when it was performed. Was it understood to be an homage?
Madeline in a room is another story. Madeline in a room is a fact that you must deal with. She's a very, very powerful person.
So was it an homage to her?
It might have been something more shamanistic, I think.
Josh, what do you think of the connection between Blanc and Ginz?
I think it definitely is an homage, but I mean, is it, you know, it's only the title of the book. Is it really a reading of the book? Is it a version from the book? Is it about presidents today versus what in the book from Ginz is from 1984?
And there's a lot of Reagan in it as well as references to other presidents.
Yeah.
What the president will say and do. What the president will say and do. What the president will say and do. What the president will say and do.
Kenny, let me ask you, is there content in this piece?
I think the medium is the message with this piece. I think it's not really a reading of the book. It's a reading around the book, through the book. It creates its own piece and its own sense of content that I think is quite different than the content in the book.
So are you suggesting that there is nothing to say about the distinction between saying and doing? Is it silly to get into a reading of that?
Well, I think there's certainly poems and sound poems that actually say and do, and then there are other ones that simply say and do something else because everything does something. So it depends on your sense of what you're looking for out of a sound poem.
Tracy, what do you think about saying and doing?
Yeah, there's a lot I could say about that because it's one of my areas of interest in terms of speech act theory. I think just to address this particular piece, though, I try to listen to sound poems with very sort of like literal ears about what certain sounds signify. And with Blanc's piece, there were certain things I just want to outline really quickly that I heard him saying. One is to go from the official voice to the repressed voice. And there was a point when he's making a transition to more sonic-oriented stuff where I just got like a little taste of like Sousa.
Really?
Very like anthem-y. The president, you know what I mean? Like at first it sounded declarative and then it sounded marching, like a marching. And you know he's a composer, so I think this sort of allusion to the parade, the patriotic parade, and that was just indicated in that line. And then when it gets later, when it comes to a later part, and I think this also has to do with his physical presence, Kenny, I just kept thinking about chickens. And I think that is a metaphor for what the presidents say and do. So I just kept hearing, whoop, 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 you know, and I was just like, oh, he's saying they're chickens.
So it goes from patriotic music to a mock.
Right, right, right.
Tracy, I mean, every sound, no matter how abstract, has emotional content.
Mm-hmm. You but know. I'm talking about vocabulary content also. Like, I think that at the end when he says, I mean, I don't want to do bad Blanc and disrespect him here, but there's a point where he just like pulls the word in and it sounds like he's saying what the president will say and. There's a few specific words that I think he's saying in the piece that reference authority, lying, cowardice, fear, repression.
So it's a political poem. It's a sound poem that's a political poem.
I think so.
The form of the poem is its politics.
Yeah, and a very specific kind of politics, electoral politics.
Josh? Yeah, I agree it's a political poem too. Maybe there's sort of two lines of politics that I wanted to think about, though. One would be sort of the politician's rhetoric side, and maybe it's going aggressively against that. In other words, that politicians use or they degrade language. They turn it into something that doesn't say or do much of anything.
But wait a minute, I'm a little confused because the achievement of this kind of sound poet is the degradation. So we sit in the audience and celebrate how the voice could do such a thing. And what you're saying is that degradation is also a negative comment on American politics.
Yeah, I think also degradation works both ways. I mean, okay, so if presidents use, you know, turn words into rhetoric and then evacuate it of meaning and doing, let's look at it on the flip side and think of how we are left with that language as, you know, individual actors, and we have degraded language. And so he's demonstrating our, you know, inability to really speak and act in the world as well.
Well, when my kids, who are teenagers and very interested in American politics, you know, insofar as, you know, they're following the election, they overheard this. My daughter said, oh, it's blah, 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 blah. In other words, oh, he's talking about how politicians speak, and eventually if you just listen to them long enough, you'll just hear sounds, empty sounds. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
It's all scripted.
Is Hannah right? Blah, blah, blah?
I think it's a fantastic thing if you listen to any of the debates, or if you listen to the State of the Nation speech, and the next day, the news speak on the New York Times says, Bush focuses on war and taxes. Could there ever have been a more Clark Kentish line rolled out about that? I mean, of course, it really is blah, blah, blah. I think Hannah has got it right on the nose.
As always, Kenny, sometimes when we talk, and especially if I'm in a teaching mode, and we start talking about radical forms and political sound poetry, and I can't wait to hear Tracy on this topic too, you get a little nervous because you don't take it that serious. You don't like to do serious politics with this stuff. You think there's much more pleasure in it, and politics perhaps belies the pleasure. Am I right about that?
Okay. Actually, can I add maybe a little story
about
that?
As long as he answers the question.
Yeah.
Oh, a story about Kenny.
About
good.
This, yeah.
Okay,
because
good.
One time Kenny and I were actually, this was a couple years ago, just having a beer, and Kenny says to me, he says, basically, I don't care what the president says and does. It doesn't matter to me. It could be Bush doing whatever he wants. It really, as long as I can do my art, it's fine with whoever's out there.
Kenny being
so I've just
arty.
Is that always
okay,
the case?
Kenny,
do you still
you're
feel
on?
It?
Well, I mean, it was sort of Cage was an anarchist, and he said, "But if I refuse to pay my taxes, I can no longer do my work."
And the work
so
is
therefore,
primary.
The work is primary, and therefore Cage, reluctantly, paid his taxes.
Well, you used a perfect example to defend your point because Cage is considered to be a radical person politically.
Cage was a radical person, but you look at the difference between Cage and Ginsburg. I mean, one was out on the streets. Cage never went to a protest. Cage felt that by protesting the government, in fact, you were simply upholding the government. Best to ignore it. Cage was of an anarchist mind that said if we all stopped voting, the government would be forced to collapse.
Tracy, let me reduce Kenny's apolitical position as such and ask you to assume that you would want to reclaim the politics that's possible in sound poetry.
Oh, yeah. Well, all my sound poetry is political, so I guess, yeah, I would.
So what do you say to Kenny to bring him back under the tent?
I don't know if I'm trying to force people under the tent. Per se, especially not
get
Kenny.
Under the tent.
Especially Kenny, he's such a bad house guest.
He really is not good under the tent.
No, I'm just joking. But no, I think that there is room for people who are just about the work. But I think the inspiration and the ramifications of what they do are intended for political ways. And I just think of so many people that I've been influenced by, that the fact that they're making another choice ended up being a very political statement, like Miles Davis going electric, like Jimi Hendrix going electric, like Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells going electric and spacey, you know. All of these references for me in terms of like black cultural ethos, experimentation, experimenting with certain prescribed notions are really clearly political. And in my personal sound poems, I constructed them, I think, because I didn't want people to avoid the politics of the situation. And I mean by that, like the power dynamics of having to be confronted with the sexual abuse of a girl, the abuse of a spouse, not being able to walk away from that because it has a physical underpinning, a physical relationship that's not about the literary vocabulary that you can sort of like analyze as abstract when it gets too scary. So I think Kenny and I have very, you know, different and possibly quite complementary approaches to what sound poetry can and should do. And I also just noted quickly that one of the things that Yacht Blanc talked about a lot in his interviews was how he preceded a lot of the people who are kind of becoming known as performance artists and stuff like that. And I think in that is embedded a political statement. The politics of not only being first, but not being afraid to be marginalized, to sound strange, etc.
Josh, what do you think of what might appear from our side of the table to be a distinction in the sound poetry community between the, let's say, the political end of it
and the
formal or aesthetic end of it? Not to, that distinction is only good for a conversation because it falls apart pretty quickly. But your business is to make something of distinction, so go ahead, Josh.
Sure. Well, I mean, yeah, sometimes I would think of Kenny as a formalist, and it's only the radical, like, rethinking of form that is what's at stake. What Tracy's saying is the political, not just the political presence of this poem, and whether it incites political action, because I want to, every time we talk about politics, we use it very vague, but if there's no action there, then I don't know if we can call it politics. But so Tracy was thinking not just the presence of this poem, but also the long history of political of oral poetry.
Well, when Gertrude Stein talks about saying as a kind of doing, or really writing as a kind of doing, and she's constantly playing that, nobody for a moment thinks that it's referring to a doing as in a political intervention. And yet the same split occurs in people talking about Gertrude Stein. Some feel that she's a political radical in a way.
Mm. Yeah. Can I mention maybe one thing about this poem that strikes me as very political that we haven't talked about yet, is that I would actually say that it becomes, at the very end, the guttural, like, grunting language is, to me, sounds like almost what I would call, like, Guantanamo kind of speak at a moment there. Like, what the president will say and do ends in these guttural pains.
Torture.
Tortured
speech.
Torture, mm-hmm. Muted, muffled, vomiting, suffocation. Mm-hmm. That's what I hear at the end.
Ubu has a wonderful selection of Yacht Blanc, and one could go there and find, for instance, a piece called Frictional. Frictional is simply Yacht Blanc making a series of sounds as the words rub up or bump up against the teeth or the lips or the tongue, and it's not anything more or less than that. And that may actually be more characteristic of Yacht Blanc, and I guess I wonder how comfortable it is or how right it is, appropriate it is, for Yacht Blanc to do this seemingly political thing using this political phrase, but maybe not doing anything political at all.
I'd like you to give me an example of any semantic unit that doesn't have political significance.
How about all the words of the New York Times?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you deal with language, you're dealing with politics, quite frankly. And the question is, then how much you're going to twist it? How much you're going to go into it to torque it to either bring this thing out? Or do you just simply present it on the table and suddenly, if the content is rancid, that might rise to the top?
But Tracy, don't you think that there can be more or less? I mean, when I hear you, I know it's a bit of a set piece for you, and I'm sorry to bring it up as opposed to many other pieces that you've done, but your Chain Gang piece, which is so politically freighted because of the phrase and because of the historical references, that while Kenny is right, and it's a nice position, to the fallback position of saying that, you know, what semantically isn't political, isn't there more and less political? Isn't chain gang more political than frictional?
I don't.
Or than Christian Buck?
I think it depends on what we mean by political. I think that a lot of my choice as a sound poet is to do stuff that's explicitly political. None of my sound poems are non-political, I don't think. But I think that there's a sort of, as I tried to say before with Hendrix and Miles and LaBelle, there are political implications to just making another choice. And it's interesting because I was saying to Sam Delaney at Temple the same thing, because he says, I'm not an experimental writer. And I was like, you were writing black queer science fiction 30 years ago. That's experimental conceptually, even though the form it takes is not, you know, it's like conventional writing. And that's one of the reasons why you can't get away from it just saying, oh, that's weird, I don't know what he's talking about. So I think there are degrees to which people interpret things politically, and that's what makes them subversive, insidious, and like flying over the head for people who are looking for a particular thing. But then you had, real quick, you know, J. Edgar Hoover interpreting like every popular song as like a political reference because of his paranoia.
It was a whole building full of hermeneutics.
Right.
The FBI.
Right. Can I mention that, though, if every word is political, then, I mean, where is politics anymore? Doesn't that evacuate it of political? That's,
Kenny would like that, that
way,
I think.
I'm Cajun in that way, and I look forward to the evacuation of politics.
Before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a final word on this piece, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Who wants to start?
One thing that wasn't brought up about it is that it's in the tradition of the permutation poem, as pioneered by Brian Gysin, and where a certain phrase gets repeated and slowly breaks down and gets recombined. I think it's a great example of a permutation poem. And I want to just point people to the greatest permutation poem of all times is a poem entitled, Why Am I So Depressed? And you can find that on UbuWeb. A breakdown, a literal breakdown of that. It's very, very beautiful.
That's great. Thank you. Tracy?
I think Yacht Blanc is a challenging figure at first for people who are not accustomed to listening for sounds as poetry. It just sounds like somebody having a fit or something. But I think sort of listening without bias and sort of deconstructing what the significance of every sound, what does this sound mean to you, is an easy way to access it. It's sort of like free jazz. If you just listen to it, it sounds, if you're not familiar, it just sounds like noise. But if you think about it as different solos interacting, then it doesn't feel as inaccessible. And I feel like all sound poems, and particularly Yacht Blanc, who is definitely accessing his European heritage in terms of the way that he approaches certain sounds that are Germanic and easeful to his voice, makes it sound, I think, in some ways heightened politically in a way for us because we have a different sort of language reference, and so those sounds are more extreme to us.
Great, thank you. Josh?
I mean, maybe also another context to think of other than jazz actually would be punk music to me, because mm-hmm. I think there's, mm-hmm. I would describe what he's doing as sort of punking this title and punking poetry. And by that I mean he's turning music into noise rather than the other way around, which we usually value. We want noise to be filtered and rendered into information, and here he's got information that's slowly dissipating into noise.
We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail, puff up, commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So who wants to gather a little paradise? Tracy?
Yeah, I really appreciated this segment, Al, because I wanted to offer you guys to hear a contrasting voice that I think is doing certain things physically to Yacht Blanc, and that's Kenny Muhammad, who's known as the Human Orchestra, and he's a hip-hop beatbox artist. But if you just think about like where the sounds are located in his throat, it's very much along the lines of where Yacht Blanc is placing things. That also, you know, Razel, the godfather of noise, does that too. Really, really interesting to compare him with someone like Yacht Blanc.
Kenny, gather some paradise.
Well, I'm going to gather up your sister institution and pump a little bit of UbuWeb You should be on the lookout this spring, probably in April. Art Forum is doing an enormous article on UbuWeb. And then this summer, the summer issue of Parquet is doing a big piece on UbuWeb as well. So two things to look out for.
Thank you, Kenny. I'll gather a little paradise quickly by quoting Madeleine Ginn's What the President Will Say and Do, her preface, one line, and it's this: nobody doesn't want a president who is not a shaman. And that's all the shamanism we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Josh Schuster, Kenny Goldsmith, and Tracy Morris, and to my co-producer, Mark Lindsay, and Poem Talk's director, engineer, and editor, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.